Okay, this is continuing with John Baldwin on July 26th, 72. So this fellow went out and he found the satellite by luck very quickly.
Yes. And so then it became a full-scale operation that pretty well everybody in the group was involved in either building simple arrays, joining them together. In fact, you could, I mean, the signals were strong, so you could pick them up on a dipole. But by having dipoles in suitable directions to make interference patterns, you could hope to do some positional measurements. And then it was the kind of thing that obviously absolutely suited the people in the group who had been in radar research. Because it was the same kind of conditions of working under extreme pressure. And Ken Machin, for instance, came back from zoology for those 2 or 3 weeks and worked with us a lot of the time. He was particularly concerned with measuring the frequency to get the Doppler shift. Because by measuring the changing Doppler frequency, right. You could.
So it was a warlike, wartime like.
With extremely crude apparatus, because there was no simple sort of frequency measuring devices. The way the frequency in the Doppler case was measured was by having an oscillator, beating it against the signal coming in, and trying to keep Lissajous figures stationary on a scope by changing the frequency
of the oscillator.
No, the oscillator,
where it peaked.
Mm.
And where it's, yeah, I see, where it's stationary.
To keep the figure roughly stationary. And that was a very hairy experiment. And the difficulty was, of course, that this satellite came around every 90 minutes, day and night. And I don't think anybody, well, the rest of us certainly had worked so continuously, so hard. It was only for a period of about a month altogether. For the first satellite, we had to learn all the things about dynamical astronomy, which again, we didn't know at all. The place was filled with newspaper reporters. In fact, it was our first meeting with John Maddox, who was a newspaper reporter for the Manchester Guardian then.
Yeah.
And while most of them were sitting around talking or reading things, we were trying to figure out what the elements of an orbit were and how you could hope to measure these and determine them. And there was this chap we'd not noticed before sitting quietly in the corner of the room, who was a newspaper reporter, but looking over his shoulder, he was reading a book on celestial dynamics, which was rather impressive for a newspaper reporter. It turned out to be John Maddox, who'd been a theoretical physicist. And
I see. And is he still a science reporter?
Well, he then became editor of Nature.
Oh, I see.
And he's now, he's now moved off that, but he was editor of Nature for quite a long time, and he was responsible for, you know, Nature splitting up into three sections and this sort of thing. He's very interested in dissemination of science and how it ought to be operated.
So you
so he was helpful.
You feverishly worked on this a month and then published it somewhere?
Yes, it was published in Nature. Now, and I don't know. My memory is that in either 2 weeks or 3 weeks from the launch date, we've actually got the elements of an orbit, a measure of the density of the upper atmosphere, and things of this sort. We were obviously taken seriously on that occasion because we had a visitation from Hirschmanso. Sadler and one or two other people who I now can't recall came up to find out about this, and they said, "Well, you know, had we got an orbit?" We said, "Yes." And they said, "Well, you know, have you got the elements of the orbit?" And we said, "Well, what do you mean?" elements of the orbit. It then emerged that there were various things that we hadn't the least idea about, which were really rather essential as far as astronomers were concerned. We just thought we knew where it was, and as far as we were concerned, that was an orbit.
Right, right.
Anyway, so... but that period, I think it took people quite a long time to recover, because they really worked for about a fortnight with almost no sleep at all.
Yeah.
But it was very exciting while it happened.
So when you published this, there still was no information coming from the Russians. I mean, these were the first orbits known to the Western world.
First published ones. I mean, it's hard to know.
Well, of course, the military.
The military presumably must have been working pretty feverishly as well, but they had to keep quiet about it.
Was Goddard working on this also? Or hadn't Lovell gotten onto this space science?
Well, not to the extent that they had later. They must have been working on it at quite an early stage. And I'm sure that's something you could get from either press reports or from published things. And apart from that, what else were you hoping to get out of it? There was one person who was starting to work on the polarization of it and the change of polarization and narrow derivation and that kind of thing. And then at the end of a month, the second one went up. And it was almost on that day, or the day within 2 or 3 days, certainly the first week of November, there was a very violent storm in Cambridge, gale, and in fact there was a track across East Anglia of about 200 yards wide where there was 90 mile an hour gusts, which were quite really unheard of. And it passed straight through the observatory.
Almost a tornado.
Yeah. And it passed through the observatory where the new telescope, as it was then, which was going to be the 4C interferometer, was being built. And it caused extensive damage. And the next day we stopped observing satellites altogether. We dropped the whole thing and turned our attention to trying to pick up the pieces.
Otherwise you probably would have done the same for the second satellite.
Quite likely, yes. Yeah. The future of the... As this was, again, the next really large grant that we'd got. We got the grant from Mullard's, in this case, to build the Mullard Observatory. It was £100,000 over 10 years.
From the firm, same one that makes the tubes.
Yes, to make the tubes, yes. And about half of this was to build the... the 4C interferometer. Some of that was also government money. I couldn't actually state what the division was, but that's what we're going to do this week.
After the 2C survey, what was the next step?
Well, it was to change the frequency of the same telescope to 159 megahertz and do it again as the 3C survey. So this was therefore the same instrument and 4 times as much resolution.
This was mainly for resolution, not for spectra or...?
No, it was mainly for resolution, yes. Because it had become clear by then, of course, that we had confusion problems in 2C. We wanted to clear those up. But we'd started at the lower frequency just because technically keeping however many it was, 8 preamplifiers going at 80 megahertz, was just not easy for long lengths of time, and at 150 to start with, we just couldn't have done it. So that was just doing what was technically feasible. And that was the survey of which David Edge was the principal person connected with it. And it was really the results of that survey which at least confirmed that the slope of the source counts was steeper than 1.5, although not as steep as in 2C. It was at the end of that the various papers discussing what sort of evolutionary models you might consider came out, and it was more at that stage that the real arguments started than at the early stage. I mean, the fiercest arguments, I suppose, were about 1957-58,
mm-hmm.
Some of which is reflected in the Paris Symposium, and you can get some flavour of how acrimonious the debate were by reading the discussion, which is quite well reported.
Mm.
And also the famous occasion when it was when the results were really announced at the Royal Astronomical Society. That was made more dramatic than had been intended by there had been a meeting with the press beforehand. Martin Ryle had talked to them and told them about the results. And this was, of course, mainly the Daily Press, who were going to be in press the next day. But in fact, the Evening Standard got into press that afternoon, and so the people coming into the meeting were selling them essentially on the steps of the Royal Astronomical Society, the Evening Standard saying, "Genesis proved true," or something like that. And that, of course, probably itself roused.
You mean the fact that it had gotten feelings to the popular press before it was announced to the society?
Well, no, the actual terms in which the popular press announced it, which were their own terms, of course, rather than. But even so, it meant that the debate that followed was perhaps fiercer than it might otherwise have been. And that, but of course, the actual discussions about it went on rumbling for many years, even to the present day.
What about the identification game? Was this being done at Cambridge on 3C sources, or?
To some extent, but only for some of the brighter sources, because even then the positional accuracies for many objects were just not quite good enough. I mean, unless you had positional accuracies of something like a minute of arc, then all but the most obvious ones were not certain. But by then there were quite a lot of objects, but probably only 30 or so that were really well established and widely accepted.
Were these taken as being typical of the others? That it was just a matter of position accuracy and or plate limits that...
Yes, I suppose so.
In other words, was it thought that the sample of objects was understood, or at least known what it represented?
I'm trying to remember when it was that there was the first paper in which there was some attempt to put together a luminosity distribution. And that would be Ryle and Clark, I think, from our work. And that was that as late as 1961, perhaps, even.
Hmm.
So up to that time, it was only based on a few sources that were known that said that the powers were typically of a certain value.
Yeah.
But there was not much notion of what spread in values there were. And then, of course, the 3C telescope, its survey ended in about 1956 or so, 57, and at the same time the 4C telescope was being built, and the first thing that did was to check the 3C survey and produce the revised 3C catalogue, just to make a well-established list for one thing, but also to try to end the arguments that there were as to whether the actual source list itself was a good source list. And that established that 3C itself was pretty good, much better than 2C had been.
Mm-hmm.
And it then went onto the 4C survey, which was a much longer project. Well, now, I suppose talking about the 4C instrument, one really ought to talk about aperture synthesis.
Yeah.
I'd mentioned that Pat O'Brien had done what essentially was aperture synthesis on the Sun quite early on, But I think the first telescope which was built to do this specifically was one built at 38 megahertz for the galactic background by John Blythe. And that did a survey of the galactic background. And that, his paper I think was published in 57. And this was an abiosynthesis machine, a movable T aerial.
Mm-hmm.
With a resolution of 2 or 3 degrees, not a very high resolution instrument, but it was a tryout of the principle, which seemed to be fairly clear, and had relationships to the Mills Cross, but it was something that didn't have both arms there all the time. It only had one fixed arm and a movable north-south part. And I think it was a tryout for what we later built at the new observatory, which was a 38 megahertz instrument, but on a quite a bit bigger scale. So his observations were a trial of that, and I suppose they were the first observations in which we actually reduced with an electronic computer. I seem to remember him doing something which I didn't understand, that was to do with a computer. And
ever since, you haven't trusted computers.
No, unfortunately, I have had a period of about 3 years when I was rather closely involved. And
no, he's kidding.
So
who was the one that developed this idea of aperture synthesis? Was it Blythe?
It was Martin Ryle, himself, who thought of it, I think. But there was a lot of discussions between him and Tony Hewish, which led to them writing their paper about the principles of how the various ways it could be done. And that was about 19. But that was after the telescope Lord's Bridge had been built, the 4C telescope, which again was an aperture synthesis instrument in one dimension.
This paper, is that one of the ones that's in the proceedings of the RAS, I seem to, or am I
Monthly Notices, yes.
No, it's in Monthly Notices.
Yeah. But that paper was certainly before the idea of Earth rotation synthesis had come in. So that it's probably hard to disentangle how much each contributed to the discussion, but they obviously did a lot together on that. It's interesting that I think the background to all this was really goes back to Ratcliffe, who was the head of the radio group, who was keen on Fourier analysis and gave a very influential set of lectures on Fourier analysis and its physical interpretations.
I see.
When I was a student, that must have been in the very early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And this influenced, I suspect, all our thinking about Fourier analysis. I mean, he related it to all the branches of physics, physical optics and electronic circuitry and so on. And this formed a sort of just a common language which everybody used. And I think it's out of that, really, that its application to telescopes.
Was this pre-52?
No, I would be a student starting in 52.
Yeah. Okay.
And it would be probably that next year. Whether that was the first time the lectures had been given, I'm not sure. But about that time. Those telescopes showed, John Blythe's survey showed that it would work if you could keep the phase stability all right. So that on that basis, the two telescopes first built at Lord's Bridge, the 4C telescope and the 38 megacycle T, were both using one-dimensional synthesis. Then the first experiments using Earth rotation was an experiment that was suggested to Jan Hoogbom by Martin, which was to use two extremely small arrays, just two or three wavelengths across, and to so that essentially you didn't have to tip them to look at different parts of the sky. They looked at the whole sky. But that by doing the sums on the output, you ought to be able to find out that there was a source that had a certain size, and produce a map which showed that Cassiopeia or the Crab Nebula or something appeared on it. And so he did those experiments. Now, when would that be? He was certainly there as a student in 1957, towards the end of 57. So it must have been, I should think, probably about early 1958.
Hoogbom got his degree at...
yes, that's right. Yes, yes, he was. He did work with Tony Hewish on scattering in the outer solar corona, as seen by changes in the shape of the Crab Nebula. And sort of radial streams of matter and so on.
So this was the first Earth aperture?
Yes, that was the first trial of an idea to see whether it would work. And I'm not sure that it was thought of in terms of Earth rotation, or, well, that phrase certainly didn't come for a very long time. And I don't know whether at that time there was the idea that if you had telescopes which were quite a lot larger that you could actually track a source. I'm not sure whether that idea had come into being, because it was quite noticeable that apart from the Wurzburg dishes, of course, we didn't have a conventional dish on the site, and they were rather scorned, in fact, because they were pencil beam instruments,
right.
And we just hadn't been involved in pencil beam instruments.
So the idea of combining them with interferometry, may have come easily here,
well,
perhaps.
Yes, I'm not sure. Until later it became obvious that to build something that was going to produce high-resolution maps would have to be at a high frequency, because of the ionosphere. And at a high frequency, the cheapest way of making something was to make it a dish that already existed. So when the germs of the 1 mile telescope came into being, I couldn't date exactly. I mean, I was aware of it some time before the application for money went in, and the actual grant was given about in 1964. So the application was certainly a year before that, because it was held up because of the economic state of the country for a time. But I certainly knew nothing at all about it before 1962. That's certain. So there is a gap there between the first trial of this idea and trying to implement it in any way.
Now, do I have it correct that the fundamental difference in the Hoogbom and Ryle experiment was simply not moving the antennas, but keeping them fixed relative to the ground and just waiting with time to get the different spacings, the different UV.
Sorry, the difference between the...
Between that and previous interferometry.
In previous ones, yes.
Was rather than lugging something around a field, you just waited with time.
That's right, yes.
And let the Earth do it for you.
Yes, whereas the other ones, the other two had been specifically meridian transit instruments for doing surveying, and this was just leaving them fixed.
And these were omnidirectional this time, and later the...
Yes. There's probably an account of that experiment in Jan's thesis, I suspect. I think so. And it did show that you could synthesize a beam.
Yeah.
But actually turning that into a practical application of the idea took a little time. Partly, I think, because, of course, we were highly occupied for a long time with the 4C telescope and actually getting the 4C survey done and published and thinking about the results.
Now you haven't mentioned specifically what was the motivation for the 4C survey, given the 3C.
Well, that it was the number counts, I think, was one of the strongest things pushing that. That if the number counts were still rising rapidly, where might they go to? And with the 3C survey, you see there was 450 sources or something, and to the next stage up was essentially about it. Try and do 10 times better, or thereabouts, and the
insensitivity.
Yes, well, in as it turned out, really, in resolving power, yes, because the improvements in receiver technique meant that at no stage was the system noise limited.
I see.
I think you see the 2C telescope had been probably quite well designed to have the right resolution on some assumptions about what those radio source counts were. So that if the slope had been 3/2, it would have been quite a well, well
and you
calculated.
Have had confusion problems.
Not so well, not nearly so much.
Yeah.
But as the slope turned out to be so steep, that's the way it happened. Well, now with that in mind, the 4C telescope was designed to have more resolution in relation to its sensitivity, and so that was nearer being sensitivity limited, but again the improvement in receivers over that comparatively short time meant that even in the 4C instrument you could get down to the confusion level, and that was used again to try to make projections of what the source counts were at fainter fluxes than you could see individually, which is something that Tony Hewish did by just a Monte Carlo analysis of trying to produce source populations that would produce the right distribution of confusing amplitude. And in fact, if you compare those projections he made with the later measurements, they were pretty good. In fact, it shows that you could project quite a bit beyond the sort of place where you could see individual source as well.
Well, you were staying at low frequencies, and England was becoming more and more crowded. Was this a problem at all as time went on?
Yes, and in fact that's...
And you were getting more sensitive too. Yeah.
That's really what brought the end of the 4C survey. That was hastened by the fact that that band had to be given up to television and we had to get another band.
I see.
We'd been moved from our original site close to Cambridge out about 5-6 miles. Partly because of space, but also more particularly because of interference from the town. But once we got out there, then it was very much better there in 1957, and quite an early stage, about 1959, we started negotiations with the local planning authority to try and protect the local area for us, and well, that's been going on ever since. And so on the whole, we don't have any trouble from things really close at hand. Most of the trouble we have is long-distance interference. And that's a question of frequency allocations and people going to conferences and banging the table. And the person who got most involved with that while he was still with us was Graham Smith. And now Paul Scott has that as a full-time job, but it's a... quite a seriously piece of work. So no, the low frequencies are still quite possible, and we felt that they were the right ones to pursue, partly because we didn't have the same skills at centimeter wavelengths as existed, say, in the States, and also we felt that centimeter wave radio astronomy was just going to be much more expensive. And there wasn't the prospect that we would ever get an enormous budget.
And you were not inclined towards dishes, also.
That's right, yes. And that as we, I suppose centrally, there was the business of trying to detect radio sources, and measure their positions, and so on, and we felt that this could be done most easily and most cheaply at relatively lower frequencies and one's idea of what is a relatively low frequency has gradually drifted upwards, in fact.
Yeah.
Partly determined by technique and partly determined by
interference.
No, not interference, but measuring off the galactic background against system noise and collecting area and things of this sort.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes.
So that at the time the Fawcett interferometer was built, it was felt quite strongly that 178 was the optimum frequency for observing a large number of radio sources. By the time the 1 mile was being planned, the optimum frequency was thought to be about 400 megahertz. That frequency probably hasn't changed much since then, I think.
As being the optimum?
For seeing as faint as possible. So that's why we've stayed there.
Yeah.
And also the feeling that if other people were doing centimeter wave astronomy, which was certainly happening all over the States, then it was stupid for us to do something that other people could do as well. And as it's happened, the low-frequency astronomy has not been pursued as actively as it might have been in other places. I mean, there are one or two groups who are specifically committed to it, like the Penticton group, at really low frequencies.
Clark Lake Array that Bill Erickson has.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
They're exceptions, almost.
Yes, they are. So that, there's still quite a lot of work to be done there.
Well, let's see. That's the 4C. Or is there anything else that you wanted to...
No, nothing about that, I think, is that.
And I guess we're up to the 1 mile array era.
Yes, and that, again, was another step of factor of 10 in cost. You see, the 2C was about 5,000, the 4C telescope was 50,000, and that was 500,000 for the 1 mile. But in fact, it was a much bigger step in terms of angular resolution and faintness of sources and so on. It was much the biggest step that we'd ever taken, and therefore was more uncertain as to how well everything was going to work, because although the principle had been established, I suppose, by the early experiments with Jan Hopem, then there'd been a much more full-scale test using parts of the 4C telescope by Ryle and Neville, looking at the North Pole, where you didn't in fact have to steer the telescope.
Right, I remember that.
So that was important. And in fact, it's quite interesting that when the results of that had just been analysed, there was a conference at Hirschmannsau at Easter, as there is every year, of which these results just being out were shown. And it so happened that one of the invited people there that year was Oort. And he was obviously tremendously impressed with this and went away sort of with a pondering look.
I see.
And I wonder whether it influenced him at that stage or not.
This is what year?
That would be, 63, I suppose. So that was while just at the stage when the 1 mile was beginning to be built. This showed at least that the computing could be done and that it did work.
And it was feasible, yeah.
So that was a relief. But whether the other aspects of the 1 mile, which were new to us, were having something that was much more complicated in that it was something that was actually tracking while people weren't going to be present. It was going to have some measure of sort of semi-computer control, and it had to have a lot of logic circuits and so on in it, which we'd not been involved with at all until that stage. It was the first time, in fact, we'd used transistors in radio circuits.
Oh, yeah.
We've been on tubes all the way up there for until...
Get a good price on the tubes, I suppose.
19. No, we didn't. No.
Really?
There was nothing... After the initial grant, there was no further sort of official connection with Mallards.
I see.
Except that they were always very glad to help on any kind of sort of occasion.
Yeah.
That was, because of course it involved also publicity for them, apart from anything else. But there wasn't any technical backup from Mollard's. So that was much more a step in the dark than anything that had been done before, I think.
Well, this aperture synthesis was also, with dishes, was a difference in direction in that you were looking at individual sources more also, rather than...
That's right, but it was designed, it was designed to do both, you see, as it was designed to do structure of radio sources, but also to try to do the number counts better. And it so turned out that at those sort of frequencies it could do both reasonably well. And that did really mark a departure and a new phase of interest in getting at the structure of sources, which we'd done nothing very much in before.
Which has continued with the whole history of the mile and the half mile.
Yes, has been structure, trying to understand the physics of particular objects rather than the statistical properties of the large samples.
Yeah.
Yes, because I mean, in the last sort of 4 or 5 years, work on cosmology has really been confined to just 2 or 3 people who were interested in that field.
Well, I guess also there came a point where to do any more significant survey in terms of resolution or sensitivity or anything else was just too gigantic a task. In other words, the sky had been covered to what you could do in a few years.
Yes. Yeah.
And,
yes, to go fainter was going to be difficult, and to do much larger areas of sky was also going to be difficult.
That makes sense.
So that interest did move away from that, and most people have been involved in working on the structures of sources.
Now, one thing that happened with the... I get confused between the 1 mile and the half mile, never having seen them. which one was the one that does the hydrogen...
That's the half mile.
The half mile,
which makes use of the track that had been built for the 1 mile.
And this was the first time that any hydrogen work had been done.
Yeah.
At Cambridge.
That's right.
And why this long wait?
Well, I suppose it was the feeling that hydrogen was mine work was being done elsewhere. It was single dish work.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Yes. But also, I think that there's been a feeling that we're not a group that's founded on astronomy. We're founded on a group that started from a physics lab and radio techniques
right.
And so on. And so that because a thing happened to be astronomically related to optical astronomy or something, didn't carry any weight at all. It's just a question of whether it was interesting from other reasons or not. So there wasn't, you know, particular pressure to find out what the actual structure of our galaxy was like, just because other people happened to be interested in it. So that would be a key reason for keeping out of it. For instance, I'm sure that Martin Ryle is much more interested in seeing things in the sky which are very difficult to explain on any, you know, and there's no other evidence relating to them. You start a problem from scratch, so you don't have to read anything. You don't have to bother about anybody else. You just, here's this problem. It's very interesting. Let's see if you can sort it out.
You set up the problems.
Rather than taking up something which is related to another field, so that's another reason I think we kept out of it until we reached a stage where we felt we could actually make a contribution that was different and that somebody else wasn't doing. And doing interferometry was such a possibility. Now we thought about doing this quite a long time ago, about 1963. We started sometime later building a line receiver to do that, with the intention, at that time, of putting it on the 1 mile telescope. But that telescope seemed so full up with things to do that eventually, quite late on in the building of the line receiver, we decided, in fact, to go ahead and build another telescope so that it could be used full time or largely. Full time on that, and so that was really why we went ahead and built the half-mile telescope. Continue a trend, I think, of building things for specific purposes, and so that they could then spend a large fraction of their time doing it. Again, that's the other part of the argument between single dishes and interferometers, that single dishes were a very versatile instrument, whereas interferometers, we argued, you could build 10 different interferometers for the price of one single dish, and so on.
And all of these instruments at Cambridge were designed for a primary task.
Yes, I think so.
Unlike many single dishes, which you're thinking somewhat of what they're going to do, but...
Yes, but it might be very versatile and would...
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a definite difference in philosophy.
Yes, and that got hardened sort of through experience and the years of different observatories doing different things. Then, I suppose the only other thing then is pulsars.
Yeah, if you could just tell me some of your impressions.
Well, of course, that arose through building another special purpose instrument. It was an instrument to study interplanetary scintillation of a large number of sources, which had been found with a 4C telescope and then decided they ought to do something to investigate it properly. That, of course, that's another side of why we've been interested in low frequencies, in that it's there you get scattering and scintillation effects and so on, and there's a great sort of history of in the radio group of people interested in scattering problems and through the ionosphere, that kind of thing, and diffraction theory generally.
Yeah, going all the way back to the original, was it Cygnus Day?
Yes. Yes, but then, yes, before that, the whole sort of all the theoreticians in the radio group, of whom Budden is still left, is, you know, he's one of his principal interests is diffraction from irregular media. And this is tied in quite nicely. And the first thing that Tony Hewish did, yes, was ionospheric scattering in from Cygnus A, and then went on to scattering in the solar corona, and then to interplanetary scattering and so on. So
he just keeps moving further away.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and then when he got onto pulsars, you see it was interstellar scattering,
right.
This sort of thing.
Next will be intergalactic.
Well, yes, people have obviously done the calculations, but haven't found
doesn't
it.
Look too,
doesn't look too good. So they built this large array at 80 megahertz, about 4 or 4.5 acres of dipoles, which was a home-built job again, and started work with it. And I suppose it had been working for several months anyway when Jocelyn Bell, who was one of the several people working on it, it was her job to actually go through the daily records and mark down sources that looked promising, because of course interplanetary scintillation doesn't happen every day, it depends where it is in relation to the sun and so on. So you want to keep a catalogue of sources that are possibilities.
But, how directional is this array?
It's a transit instrument. It's got a beam which is it's about a degree in right ascension and about it has multiple beams in declination, but they must be about 4 degrees, I suppose, in declination.
But could you not go through the source catalogs and find out which are going to be passing close to the sun or in the ecliptic?
Oh, I see. Well. Yes, but the actual sensitivity of the system was that it was certainly going to be able to see sources in 4C, but its sensitivity for and after that it would be confusion limited. But if the number of scintillating sources is a relatively small fraction of the whole, then you were going to be able to see much fainter objects because they weren't going to be confusion limited. If you see what I mean. If you put the output of the instrument through a filter, so you remove all sources that don't scintillate, you're starting with a new sky again, essentially.
Oh, yes, I see what you're saying.
And then you could see down to sources that were fainter than the 4C limit.
Yes.
And so that you really had no clue of what you were looking for, you really had to start and make a survey. So that they were just doing that in a systematic way, and hoping that in many cases they could assign a certain scintillation to a particular known source. But not in all cases.
And were they finding scintillating sources?
Yes. I mean, quite a large number. There would be, I suppose, a third of all sources, something like that, show scintillation. So that's I mean, this was a catalogue, therefore, it was going to be 1,000 sources or more,
yeah,
eventually. So you had to write everything down in a systematic way, because some things, as I say, only appeared on a few days. And the filter that it went through that picked up the high-frequency scintillation gave a sort of a well-recognized pattern for scintillating sources. And then she kept coming across things which didn't, in fact, fit into this. Now, one of the criteria you look for in a scintillating source was the shape of the pattern, the fact that it had the right width for the primary polar diagram of the telescope,